good morning to you all. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO. Well, welcome. I've got more than 60 minutes of radio for you between now and 11 a.m., so we're going to cut to the chase and get right into it. We're going to first talk a little bit about a brand new U.S. military plan regarding domestic response to terrorism or other activities on a scale along those lines. And then in the later part of the program, we'll be talking all about the melting of Siberia, the permafrost ringing the Arctic, and all things ice and cold water related up north. So first, to talk about the new Northern Command plans regarding domestic response to terrorism, I'm very pleased to bring to our airwaves Ivan Ulrich. He is the director of the Strategic Security Project at the Federation of American Scientists. Welcome to our airwaves, Ivan.
All right, glad to be here.
And you are also currently an adjunct professor in the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University.
Yes.
And a lot of your research is focused on sizing military forces, appropriate military technology, and arms control.
Mm-hmm. That's what I usually focus on here at the Federation of American Scientists.
Now, the new Northern Command battle plan, as it's been described, is not absolutely new news. It's been in development for a little while, and Bradley Graham at the Washington Post had a front-page story a week ago Monday, that's August 8th,
mm-hmm.
regarding this new plan, and he describes it as a historic shift for the Pentagon to be planning for active duty troops to be used in a law enforcement context, in part, for the U.S. Is his assessment of this as a historic shift and kind of a groundbreaking event for the Pentagon accurate, in your opinion?
It's largely accurate, perhaps a slight exaggeration. We have to keep in mind that the each of the states has a National Guard notionally under control of the governor of that state. And you know, I grew up in Florida, for example, and after hurricanes, the National Guard would often be called up to provide security and help with helping people whose homes have been destroyed and even directing traffic, that sort of thing. So there is something, that is a precedent. Also, in wartime, clearly, we have had military have taken over areas and provided security for secure military facilities and research laboratories and that sort of thing. So some of this has happened. I think that what is new is that they're planning this in advance, and it's in a time when we're not in an officially congressionally declared war, and and these are federal forces, not state National Guard forces. Those are new things here. So it is something new. I don't know if it's quite as earth-shattering as he suggests, but yeah, this is something new.
Now there seems to be concerns regarding jurisdiction, both between military and civilian control of different types of activities in a response,
mm-hmm.
and then there's the issue of the temporary nature of this or the permanent nature of this in a circumstance.
Yeah, well, one thing that we should make clear is that this document, whether it's a planning document or exactly what it is, we don't have that. That's not been made public before. That's still secret. And almost everything we know about this is based on this article that appeared in the Washington Post and a very few other public statements. And so we have to be a little bit cautious about what the thing is, because I'm not quite certain that we absolutely know. But yes, there are questions if something happens in some rural area and a general shows up with 3,000 troops, you know, is he going to take orders from the local rural sheriff or not? There is that concern. Do state local political leaders, will they have control over this person, or does he report up through federal channels? And I think all of that is unknown and needs to be worked out if we're going to go ahead with this type of approach of using the military as an emergency backup in case of a terrorist attack.
And a lot of this brushes up against the Posse Comitatus Act from the 1870s, which was enacted in response to It was basically part of the deal that allowed, or yeah, I guess allowed, Union troops to leave the Reconstruction South.
Right, and that, this act in the United States. It's specifically forbidden to use the military for what is called law enforcement, which should be a civilian activity. And it's not quite clear how that would work out. That one could imagine, for example, the circumstance where there's a biological terrorist attack, and perhaps you want to enforce a quarantine. Well, if I put a ring of troops around and they say, no, you can't cross this line, is that law enforcement or not? I'm a physicist, not a lawyer, but it seems to me that that would be, you know, enforcing a law or decree. And so it would run up against that, but they're certainly aware of that and concerned about that. I see that as a major, well, one of many, many large problems with this kind of a plan.
And the Pentagon is really proactive in their public statements to reassure folks with questions along the lines of the military-civilian split in terms of control that the Pentagon will... Well, they say here in a new Homeland Defense strategy issued in June that, quote, domestic security is still primarily a civilian law enforcement function.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, this article from Bradley Graham in the August 8th Washington Post says Pentagon authorities have rejected the idea of creating large standing units dedicated to homeland missions, and they just prefer to keep troops kind of in a general pool, and some will receive homeland training. Unfortunately, there's a long history of what the Pentagon says and what it actually plans for are different.
That's true, and those are problems. And, you know, soldiers have a lot of different things they have to train for. You know, they're required to have many different skills. You want them to be able to fight in urban environments and jungles and mountains, and they have to go through training for all this and constantly renewing that training. And I think that that shows that they're not going to have dedicated forces. That shows the weakness of this proposal and why a lot of these problems are just, they're real problems, but they're man-made problems. They're not fundamental. And that we could have a similar kind of approach with civilians. For example, if you need more police forces, major metropolitan areas around the country could take the same amount of money that they would spend on the military and develop a system where they would trade off police officers for an emergency. So if something happens in, you know, Chicago, you could be flying in policemen and firemen, rescue workers, from places as far away as L.A. and New York, and within a day they could get there if we spent the resources on training and planning. The military looks like an attractive solution to this because that's where we put all the money. We're mm-hmm. spending close to $500 billion a year on the military. And so, of course, they have resources. They have excess capacity and transportation and such. But there's no law of nature that says we have to spend that on the military. We could spend that on civilian agencies and avoid all of these questions entirely. And frankly, I think it would work better. You know, the military are trained to go and attack, kill enemy and capture territory, and they have military kinds of jobs. That's dramatically different from the kinds of jobs that they have in the United States, acting with civilians to try to protect civilians, right, even in a terrorist attack.
Right. It's sort of a secondary approach to how they do
right.
things.
You have to think about most of the guys in Iraq who are doing a great job. They, you know, the infantry on the ground, they're mostly 19, 20, 21-year-olds with rifles. No, they're not the kind of people that you want necessarily to be enforcing a quarantine zone around a biological weapons attack site, right? I would much rather have civilian policemen who are trained in dealing with civilians and trained in dealing with population, you know, civilian populations and dealing with Americans, than having soldiers who are, many of them are quite young and inexperienced and have a dramatically different kind of training background than civilian police. And it's true that the military has those resources now, but there's no reason why they need to have them in the future, and we should, if whatever resources that were going to be focused on this to have the military be able to respond. If we simply spent that on civilian agencies, we could do exercises. We could pretend that, you know, Portland, Oregon had an attack, and we could fly policemen up from L.A. and down from Seattle and see how that, you know, every year do some kind of exercise. That costs a lot of money. You would have to train these people. You'd have to have them decide on communications protocols, chains of command. All of this would have to be planned ahead of time. It would take a lot of resources, but it doesn't take any more resources to train civilians to do that than to train the military to do that.
Right.
So it's just a question of where we decide to put our resources. I think that this is a made-up problem that we should not be asked to deal with.
Ivan Ulrich is the director of the Strategic Security Project at the Federation of American Scientists, and he's additionally an adjunct professor at the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University, and he joined us this morning from his office back in Washington, D.C. to talk about the new Northern Command's domestic war plans to respond to terrorist attacks and other potential crisis scenarios. Thanks a whole lot for joining us this morning, Ivan.
My pleasure.
All right. Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And we're going to do a real quick transition here and get on to what we're going to spend the rest of the hour talking about today. And that's the frozen northern part of our planet. Not exclusively northern hemisphere, but all around. My first guest, and maybe I'll introduce what all is going to be happening here. So I'm going to have a representative from the National Snow and Ice Data Center coming up in just a moment. We're going to talk a little bit about the cryosphere, the frozen world on our planet, with a particular focus on the Arctic as opposed to the Antarctic. And in a little bit, he will be joined by a British woman in France who has been working with a Siberian researcher who just released some disturbing findings regarding the permafrost in Siberia. And then towards the top of the hour, we'll actually go live on-site communication to a Canadian Coast Guard icebreaker that's in the waters off the west coast of Greenland, at 76 North, 71 West, for those of you who'd like to see a visual of that. And that'll bring us up to 11. So first, I am pleased to bring back to our airwaves Mark Serez. He works with the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado, and he has a wide range of interests regarding Arctic research, including the interaction between the atmosphere and sea ice, hydroclimatology, weather prediction, and climate change. And he has conducted field work in the Canadian Arctic on sea ice and ice caps, as well as on the Alaskan tundra. So welcome back to our airwaves, Mark.
Oh, thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, we're really glad that you're available. You haven't worked in Siberia at all, but I know that you're marginally familiar with some of the recent findings regarding the permafrost. Can you give us a basic primer on what permafrost is, where it is, and why it's important?
Okay, I can try that. Well, most of the Arctic region is underlain by permafrost. Permafrost is basically defined as perennially frozen ground. That is ground that's frozen throughout the year. Now, this permafrost is usually overlain by what we call an active layer. This is the part of the soil, say the first meter or so, that freezes and thaws on an annual basis. So you've got this active layer, and underneath that is the permafrost. Right? Now, the permafrost has a number of key effects on how the Arctic functions. One of this is how it affects the hydrology. If we think of a river system, say like the Mississippi River, you get rain or snow that falls on the top of it, okay? And then maybe the snow melts, but a lot of it percolates down into the ground, keeps the ground fairly wet, then some of it runs out into the rivers. Well, what happens with this permafrost is that it's essentially an impermeable layer. It's as if you poured water on a linoleum floor. It can't sink in. So basically what happens is the snow and precipitation that we get in the Arctic basically runs right down through these river channels. Now, this has effects on, for example, things like evaporation rates in the Arctic. Because we get rid of that water quickly down through the river channels, you don't get too much evaporation, although it's fairly cold. That's another reason. But it also has very strong effects on the ecosystems. For example, because you've got that permafrost layer, only certain types of plants can grow there. You can't get big trees like oak trees or something. I mean, it's already cold up there, but you can't get these larger vegetation because it can't root down into that permafrost. Well, if we start to change that permafrost, start to melt that permafrost, what we can do is start to change, for example, the types of vegetation we get into the Arctic. That, in turn, starts to influence things like transpiration rates. You get plants with larger leaf areas, for example. Changes things like evaporation. That starts to have what we call feedbacks on the climate system. Now, also, we know that there's a lot of potential carbon dioxide and methane locked up in this permafrost.
And I just
if we start to melt that out, okay, there's the potential that we could have large releases of these greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
I just want to reference for folks, methane is also known as natural gas. It's CH4.
The simplest of the hydrocarbons.
Yep. And it's 20 times as powerful a greenhouse gas in terms of its climate impact as carbon dioxide.
That's
and so
correct.
That's where a lot of the concern that scientists are expressing regarding the melting or thawing permafrost comes from, is the vast my understanding is it's really the methane and not so much the carbon dioxide in the permafrost that's the real concern, just because of the impact as a global warming gas.
That's right. In terms of the Arctic, it's really that methane flux, which my understanding is what's more important. One thing, for example, if you start to thaw this permafrost over these large bogs, these large peat areas in the Arctic, what happens is then you get things like melt ponds developing, ponds that'll develop. And so there'll be little microorganisms that'll start to grow, basically start to rot that peat, and that's where the methane comes from, okay? But, yeah, the methane is important because it's really, there's not nearly as many molecules in the atmosphere of methane as there are in carbon dioxide. But molecule for molecule, the methane is a much more powerful greenhouse gas.
Now, let's get a little bit into some of the connection between the melting permafrost and sort of other hydrological features in cold areas.
Mm-hmm.
Permafrost melting. Okay, so anytime ice melts at either pole, it's allowing water to basically stay on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And being darker than ice, it's able to absorb more water. And here you get this positive feedback loop of the more ice melts to water, the warmer it can be, so the more ice melts to water, which then theoretically is flowing into I guess primarily the Arctic Ocean, although I guess the North Atlantic is somewhat impacted,
right,
depending on, you know, the topography of the land. And then you get into issues of salinity in the oceans and broader issues of ocean circulation patterns. And, you know, you might think, oh, well, you know, little melt ponds in the permafrost, how does that relate to, you know, ocean circulation? And it's, you know, it's all connected at a different level of scale. And we also see that the Arctic ice, the actual sea ice, is shrinking in its extent year to year. And this is an area that you have a bunch of background in. Can you tell us your assessment of how the Arctic sea ice trend is looking? I'm actually looking at a chart in front of me for the past 27 years, and it's got a slight decline month to month. Is that something that has been viewed in history, or is this really an anomaly?
Okay, well, it appears to be an anomaly. I think some of the things you're talking about just previously, you're hitting on a lot of the different parts of the system that we're concerned about. And one of the things we do see is this loss of Arctic sea ice. Now, since about 1979, we've been able to assess the extent of Arctic sea ice quite accurately. This is from satellite sensors, satellites that orbit over the North Pole. And we've seen this general decline in the sea ice cover. But what we've seen is in the past 4 or 5 years, that rate of decline has increased remarkably. It seems like the bottom's starting to drop out of the system. Since the year 2002, every autumn, every September, has seen record or near record minima in the sea ice extent. So this slow downward trend appears to be accelerating. Now, in terms of the climate impacts of this sort of thing, one of the things we're really concerned about is what we call feedbacks, positive feedbacks in the climate system. The idea is this. Let's say we have an initial warming in the Arctic caused by greenhouse gases. You warm up the Arctic a little bit. Well, over much of the Arctic, it's covered with sea ice and snow, which is white, very highly reflective. So what happens is if you have this initial warming, you start to melt some of this highly reflective surface, the sea ice and the snow cover. Well, now there's less of the Arctic that's covered with that highly reflective surface, so you can absorb more solar radiation on the surface. You can absorb more solar radiation into the ocean. The surface heats up. The oceans heat up. That means that the Arctic warms even a little bit more. That means that less sea ice can grow that following winter. That means that there'll be less snow in that spring. So then we can even melt more of that. And so we get this feedback going on, which means then the basic idea of this is that this initial perturbation, this initial change is amplified within the system. So that's one of the things we're concerned about. And while we know that the sea ice cover shows significant natural variability, that is just variability from year to year from natural processes, it's becoming very difficult to argue against the notion now that part of what we're seeing is these feedbacks kicking in response to the greenhouse gases. Now, we turn to something like the permafrost, same sorts of ideas that we've been seeing. We've been seeing a general warming of the Arctic. And so this appears to be, you know, melting and warming some of that permafrost. But if you start to warm and melt some of that permafrost, that means conditions can change. For example, conditions that favor the introduction of new plant species increases. For example, we get a transition from a tundra vegetation to a shrub vegetation. That can induce then also additional changes in warming. For example, the shrubs tend to be darker than the tundra, so it absorbs more solar radiation. So again, one of these feedbacks. Now, the other interesting thing, is I think this is something you hit upon, is this idea of hydrologic changes. If we look at our best climate models, they're telling us that actually, as we move into a greenhouse world, the Arctic is actually going to become wetter. Okay, precipitation is going to increase. So is evaporation, but precipitation wins. So what happens now is that river runoff to the Arctic Ocean starts to increase. And that means that we can then start to move some of this fresh water into the North Atlantic Ocean. And this hits at one of the things you talked about earlier about changes in the ocean circulation, that if we put some of this fresh water out into the North Atlantic, we might actually be able to cap this system and change what we call the thermohaline circulation. So there's a great deal of interlinked processes that we're talking about.
I'm just going to jump in here for a moment and elaborate briefly on a couple things that you mentioned. The Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, June 16 of this year, put out a press release regarding a study that a couple of researchers there produced titled, "How Much Excess Fresh Water Was Added to the North Atlantic in Recent Decades?" And this was fascinating. So they say that in an average year, about five, and so the units here are cubic kilometers. Okay?
That's right.
Nobody has an idea of what that's really going to look like. So I'm just going to say 5,000 units, because it doesn't matter. 5,000 units of fresh water flow annually from the Arctic into the North Atlantic through passages to the east and west of Greenland. In addition, these researchers said that there were 19,000 extra units over 30 years, which works out to be about 630 extra units of water a year, or about a 13% increase.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for comparison, the 630 or so extra units a year compares to the annual outflow of the Mississippi River being 500 units. Mm-hmm. So you're getting 120% of the Mississippi River's outflow in extra water every year for the past 30 years into the North Atlantic. And additionally, in May of this year, the Times Online out of Britain reported that climate researchers have detected the first signs of a slowdown in the Gulf Stream. Mm-hmm. Quoting from the article, one of the engines driving the Gulf Stream, sinking supercooled water in the Greenland Sea,
yep,
has weakened to less than a quarter of its former strength. This is Peter Wadhams, ocean physics professor at Cambridge University, who said there used to be giant chimneys in the sea where columns of cold, dense water would sink from the surface to about 3,000 meters. They have disappeared. The last time they showed up was 1997 reference here. The cold water sinking would be replaced by warm water, and that would help it flow across the Atlantic on towards Britain. Britain is at the same latitude as Siberia. But for the Gulf Stream, Britain would be a whole lot colder. And so this issue is fairly consistent news in some of the British press in a way that it isn't here, because we're not impacted with the Gulf Stream in the same way. Why don't I use that as a real brief segue to the next little segment here I want to do. And we're going to have you stick around, Mark, because we're going to be talking about the Siberian research regarding the permafrost. I'm going to just read real briefly here from the New Scientist, August 11 of this year. And then I'm going to take a real quick musical break while I get my next guest on the phone, and we will talk about Siberia from that point. So Siberia is the world's largest expanse of permafrost. It's basically a frozen peat bog, 1 million square kilometers. So picture 500 kilometers down, 2,000 kilometers across as an idea. So Western Siberia is melting. It's converting into a mass of shallow lakes. And the melting over an area the size of France and Germany has the potential to release billions of tons of methane. Sergei Kerpotin, a botanist at Tomsk State University in Russia, and Judith Markwind at the University of Oxford, who we're going to have on the phone just a minute, shared this news with the world a couple of weeks back. And Sergei is unavailable currently. I gave him a try a bunch last night, but he is inaccessible someplace in Siberia. And the entire Western Siberian subarctic has begun to melt. Kerpotin suspects that some unacknowledged threshold has been crossed, and talks in some reasonably apocalyptic language about the irreversibility of this tremendously bad phenomena that has been pushed forward. So let's take a real quick break here. Mark, you're going to stick around with us. And when I come back, Mark Serez from the National Snow and Ice Data Center will still be with us. And he will be joined by Judith Markwind from the from Oxford University, who has been working with Sergei Kerpotin, Russian botanist, studying the Siberian permafrost. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland. All right. You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. My name is Andrew Geller, and we are talking about permafrost and the Arctic and a lot of the water, the transformative processes going on with water, whether it's ice, permafrost, glacier, or actual just liquid water. So Mark Serez is continuing with us. He works with the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado, and he's got a wide range of experience studying Arctic. And also joining us now online from Oxford University via France, we have Judith Marquin. She's a former British civil servant in the Economic Service. And since the early 90s, she's been a social scientist and management consultant based at the University of Sheffield and currently Oxford University. She's been working with Tomsk State University in Tomsk, Russia, on a series of projects since 1993, particularly concerning environmental management. So welcome to you, Judith.
Welcome.
And welcome back, Mark.
I'm still here.
Okay. Now, Judith, you have been helping Sergei Kropotkin facilitate the distribution of his Siberian permafrost research into the Western press.
That is correct, yes.
How would you assess the response you've gotten from...
Overwhelming
good, overwhelming bad?
Well, good in that people are extremely receptive to the results of the research. Bad in that the whole thing demonstrates just how worrying the climate change position is and how this research adds yet another building brick to the picture which is gradually appearing.
And it seems to me, as someone who's followed this as a layperson, but fairly closely for well over a decade now, it seems like the only consistency in the results of research about climate change is that things are able to happen quicker than we realistically think they should be able to happen.
Yes, there seem to be tipping points in a whole range of climate change phenomena, and we keep on hoping that they are a long way away, and things keep happening which make it clear that they're nearer than we would like.
Now, how do you mean tipping point?
Well, the immediate one in Sergei Kropotkin's research is that the melting of the permafrost at some stage reaches a tipping point where it becomes irreversible. It becomes self-sustaining, and he is extremely worried that this has been reached already. But other ones are to do with the melting of the ice shelf off Greenland and Antarctica, to do with what might happen to the Gulf Stream. All very major phenomena, and things are suddenly much worse after the tipping point has been reached than they had been in the relative calm before.
And Mark and I have been discussing somewhat the interconnection between the melting of the permafrost and increased freshwater flow and impacts, potential impacts on ocean circulation. Mark, the Arctic and Antarctic, though we're not really talking about the Southern Pole, are the places on the Earth where the warming has been most evident. And I'm curious if you feel like that is something that will potentially be sustained throughout our kind of modern warming phase, or do you anticipate that at some point the Arctic will somewhat level off in its rate of temperature change and somewhere else on the planet will sort of take the lead in that way?
Well, I think it will level off at some point. The basic reason why the Arctic is figured to warm more strongly and warm first under a greenhouse warming, a lot of that has to do with these feedbacks, as I mentioned, and the sea ice is critical to that. Because for most of the year, the sea ice is a very effective insulator. In other words, we have in the winter, for example, we have a cold Arctic atmosphere, minus 20, minus 30 degrees C, but we have a very warm, relatively warm Arctic Ocean right at around the freezing point. But you have this atmosphere and this relatively warm ocean separated by this thin sea ice cover. By thin, I'm talking about a 2 or 3 meter ice thickness, okay, fairly thin. So the idea is that if we start to lose some of that sea ice, start to thin that sea ice down, now you can suddenly start to get large heat fluxes that come from the ocean up into the atmosphere. This is one of the key parts of this feedback. This is why the Arctic is supposed to warm more strongly. Okay? And we appear to be starting to see that now. Well, eventually you'd get to a point, of course, if there's no sea ice left, for example, it's hard to get the very large and rapid changes in the Arctic. It will continue to warm, but the rate of warming would tend to decrease at some point in the future. But we're talking here about something that would still be a century away in terms of the Arctic starting to level off.
Now, Judith, you said that the response from media to Sergei Kerpotin's research on the melting of the Siberian permafrost was overwhelming, and in the good way. I'm curious if you've had any inquiry from governments around the world regarding this research.
No, I haven't.
Would you like to be able to talk to government leaders about this?
I would prefer to have the full scientific results published and to have the scientists rather than myself, an intermediary, talking about it.
Okay.
But obviously I am acutely aware that this is a very urgent policy issue indeed, and would certainly wish that government leaders take note of it.
Now, in this news, Sergei Kerpotin's research was first made public in an article in New Scientist from August 11th, a man named Fred Pearce, and that's P-E-A-R-C-E. And towards the bottom of that article, I read something that, as someone who, as you both are, familiar with what's going on climatologically in terms of research, I read something in this article that scared me unlike few things have. Katie Walter from the University of Alaska Fairbanks told a meeting of the Arctic Research Consortium that she had found locations in eastern Siberia of methane hotspots where methane was bubbling through the thawing permafrost so quickly that the surface was unable to freeze in the middle of a Siberian winter. Now, Siberian winter draws instant visual and possibly even other sensory images to mind. And the idea that water couldn't freeze on the surface in a Siberian winter is just hard to understand. Is that a new phenomena as far as either of you are aware? The idea that, there's not water freezing on the surface of Arctic landforms as a result of methane or any other reason in the middle of a winter?
I'm not familiar with that particular line of work. It's hard for me to comment on that. But, even today, Siberia is pretty darn cold in the winter. So I would really have to learn more about that particular study to comment on it.
Okay. And Judith?
Well, it's a new idea to me, but this is actually happening. But I am reminded of something on a much smaller scale. A great deal of central heating in Siberian cities is provided as district heating with pipes from the power stations running across very large distances to the blocks of apartments which they heat. And you will see a thaw in the Siberian winter around these pipes. In other words, it doesn't take an enormous amount of heat, though it does take persistent heat to produce these bare spots. I'm horrified that the methane has started to do it, but the fact that it can be done is not so extraordinary.
Okay. Yeah, I suppose that's an important distinction, that, you know, knowing it's possible is different from it already happening.
Yes.
Well, I'd like to thank both of you for taking some time out of, Mark, for you it's still morning, and Judith, for you it's getting on towards dark.
That's right.
For taking some time out of your days to join us to talk about this important research and other findings regarding the Arctic.
My pleasure.
And mine too.
Thank you both.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Mark Serez works with the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado, and Judith Markwind of Oxford University has been helping facilitate distribution of research in the Siberian permafrost of Sergei Kerpotin from Tomsk State University, and she joined us from her home in France. I'm going to go now to a short piece of tape recorded in February of this year in Exeter at a global warming conference regarding dangerous and abrupt climate change. This is from Mariah Gallardon and TUC Radio, distributed through globalpublicmedia.com. And we're going to hear a few minutes of Jason Lowe from the Hadley Center for Climate Research in the United Kingdom speaking about Greenland. And when we return, we will have the Canadian icebreaker Amundsen, located at 76 North, 71 West online, and we will be speaking with Professor André Rochon. He is the chief scientist on board, and we will be back with him in just 1 minute.
The Greenland ice sheet will still melt, even if we stop CO2 rising at 450. And if we move along the curve to 650, then in 50% of the model versions, the ice sheet is melting. Now, another question that we're bound to ask is would the meltdown be irreversible, even if we reduced CO2 levels? And that's an incredibly difficult question to answer, especially if we want to include the feedbacks between climate and the ice sheet. And it's difficult because of the very long response times involved and the expense of running joint climate ice sheet studies. If we go back to the literature and look at the most recent papers on Greenland meltdown, then I think we find the consensus has not yet been reached. And the two most recent papers I looked at, one of them by Tony Atso et al., work at the Hadley Centre, suggested that the meltdown would be irreversible. Another paper by colleagues at the University of Bristol suggests there may be a recovery if we reduce CO2 levels. So we need to do more work on that. And something that's coming out of a study we're doing here is that the result is likely to depend on the state of the ice sheet when we reduced CO2. We're currently looking at that. Just very briefly, the second question I'm interested in is how long does it take to stabilise sea level? If we perform an experiment with a GCM where CO2 is increased over a fairly rapid period, in this case 70 years, and then stabilised at 4 times pre-industrial levels, then we see the rate of temperature increase rapidly declines. It's still increasing slightly, but it slows dramatically after the stabilisation point. If we look at the thermal expansion component of sea level rise, the rate of thermal expansion is still very large at the end of 1,000 years. There's an efolding time in this simulation for sea level of the order of 1,400 years. Now, that's just thermal expansion. We've also looked at a dynamic simulation of the ice sheet, and in this we've linked the ice sheet to the climate model in a two-way coupling so that the climate can affect the ice sheet and changes in the ice sheet can feed back on the climate. And this set of figures shows the decline of the ice sheet as it gradually withdraws from the west and from the north and south over a period of 3,000 years. And what you'll see by year 1,000, we've lost upwards of 50% of the ice sheet in this simulation. By year 3,000, we have a small remnant of an ice sheet left on the very high ground to the east of Greenland.
Jason Lowe prefaced his conclusions with a word of caution. There are many uncertainties, he said, and much research still needs to be done. But as matters stand today, this is what his team of scientists concludes. Jason Lowe.
So briefly on to the conclusions then. Deglaciation of Greenland may be triggered for even quite modest stabilization targets. It may be irreversible, but we can't say that definitively yet. And sea level is likely to continue to rise for more than 1,000 years after greenhouse gas concentrations have been stabilized. And that's even if we don't exceed the threshold for melting Greenland. If we do, that will make it more severe.
And that was Jason Lowe from the Hadley Center for Climate Research in Britain, speaking in February of this year at the Dangerous Climate Change Conference that took place in Exeter, United Kingdom. That was Mariah Gallardon, who produced the audio tape from TUC Radio, speaking in between his short segment there. And that was distributed by globalpublicmedia.com. You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland. I am actually still trying to contact the Canadian icebreaker Amundsen. It's a satellite phone they're using with somewhat spotty communication capability, and I understood that this could be a problem. And what I'm going to do now is actually just go to a short music segment here to serve as a segue, and I'll give it a couple more tries. And if we can get Professor André Rochon, chief scientist aboard the Amundsen, we'll go to him. And if not, we will do something else to close out the hour. So I'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes. Thanks for bearing with us. Okay, so we're back, and I'm pleased to report that I, in fact, was able to connect with the Canadian Coast Guard icebreaker Amundsen. And joining us now live off the coast of Greenland is chief scientist on board the research vessel, Professor André Rochon. Thank you very much for being available to us this morning.
My pleasure.
Now, last I heard yesterday, you folks are at 76 north, 71 west sort of at the north end of Baffin Sea. Is that still roughly your location?
Yes, actually we are exactly halfway between Greenland and Ellesmere Island in Canada.
Okay. Right now. Now, you folks are working on a North Water Pollyanna expedition, at least in part. I'm not sure if that's all what you're doing up there. Can you tell us what a Pollyanna is and why they're important?
The place where we are, it's called the North Water Pollyanna, and a Pollyanna is an area that is ice-free through a good part of the year, and where a lot of primary production, that is algae, are growing, and therefore it attracts grazers or organisms that feed on plankton, and then fish, and then marine mammals.
And
we are... Okay, go ahead.
I was going to say, please continue.
Okay. We are studying, actually, the evolution of the ecosystem through the years. The North Water Pollyanna program started in 1999. And now, through another research program called ArcticNet, we are looking at the evolution of the ecosystem throughout the Canadian Arctic from east to the west in the Beaufort Sea.
And what sorts of changes have you observed up there as the Arctic has warmed? Are you seeing anything unusual?
Well, the Arctic has been studied for a very short period of time, so the measurements that we make right now, some of them are being made for the first time, so it's too early for us to say if the Arctic is changing. But from the sea ice data that we were able to collect, not us personally, but other scientists were able to collect throughout the years, there are indications that the sea ice is melting, and it is reduced in area and in thickness throughout most of the Arctic so far.
Now, as I'm looking on some information from the ArcticNet website, it mentions that where you are, the North Water Pollyanna, is overwintering ground for belugas and other whales, walruses, narwhals, and I imagine many other forms of life, animal life. Is that part of the research that you're doing, or are you really more focusing on the plankton and not necessarily observing more the megafauna?
A good chunk of the researchers on board are interested in plankton. But we do have some wildlife observers on board, an Inuit wildlife observer that is noting every sighting of whales or marine mammal or seabirds that we are encountering.
Now, I actually also have, let me just rotate this to get the orientation correct. Okay, so it looks like where you guys are at this time of year does not have much in the way of ice in the water. Is that true?
That is true. I can look through my cabin window on both sides, and there is no sea ice to be seen. But that is what a Pollyanna is. That is an ice-free zone. But there are a few icebergs in view, though.
Okay, so there's nothing out of the ordinary necessarily in terms of the presence of ice flows or icebergs for this time of year?
No. And also the variability from one year to the other is quite important. So some years you cannot go in certain areas because they are completely covered by ice, while the next year they may be totally ice-free.
Okay. I'm afraid that I'm going to have to cut this short at this point, Professor Roshan. I really appreciate you making some time in your schedule to join us to talk a little bit about what's going on off the west coast of Greenland in Baffin Sea.
Thank you very much.
All right. Take care and best of luck with your expedition.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Professor Andre Roshan. He's the chief scientist aboard the Canadian Coast Guard icebreaker Amundsen, and they are currently off the western coast of Greenland, 76 north, 71 west. And that's going to do it for us today. Thank you very much for listening to the program. If you have comments or questions about anything you heard today, you can send email to kboo@riseup.net. Or regular mail to 20 South or KABU Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214.